Let us hear God's word. Go to the ant, thou sluggard. Consider her ways and be wise, which having no guide, overseer, or ruler, provideth her meat in the summer and gathereth her food in the harvest. How long wilt thou sleep, O sluggard? When wilt thou arise out of thy sleep? Get a little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to sleep. So shall thy poverty come as one that travaileth, and that wanteth, and want as an armed man. Thus ends the reading of God's holy word. This morning we come again to our series on financial stewardship, and we come this morning to consider saving and investing. Having spent several weeks thinking about money, we considered stewardship and the deceitfulness of riches, as well as financial planning. We've since then moved into the body of the course, and we've discussed making money, returning money, giving money. And just one aside on giving money, I think it's helpful for us to recognize the contrast in the Christian concerning biblical charity or giving and what's known in our day as philanthropy. Philanthropy itself, if you take it in its etymology, means the love of man. Phileo, love of anthropos, of man. But biblical charity is different than philanthropy, in that biblical charity is the manifestation of God's grace because we have received His grace. Consider the words of Christ in Matthew 10:18. Freely have ye received, freely give. So the dynamic for the Christian is different than the non-Christian philanthropist in their giving. A non-Christian philanthropist may give a lot more money than you or I give to the needy, but the motive is radically different for us. It's from our love of God and our concern for those created in His image, that we who've been freely given will freely give ourselves. Now, last Lord's Day, or actually two Lord's Days ago, we looked at paying money from Romans 13, 1 through 8. Or no, that was actually last Lord's Day. And this Lord's Day we come to look at saving money and investing money here from Proverbs 6, 6 and 11. Next Lord's Day at this time, Lord willing, we'll continue our series of surveys of the Psalms, and we'll continue to look at Psalm 44. And then in the month of August, we'll continue this series, Lord willing, looking at spending money and then implementing our financial plan, trying to get a rein on our spending. So this morning, saving money, investing money. Let's first consider saving money, then investing money. Let's use the same rubric that we've been using. Let's consider the biblical basis first, then some practical suggestions second. So saving money, biblical basis. I think here we find a biblical basis in Proverbs 6, 6 through 11. We're told to look at the creation and to notice the ant. We're to consider her ways and we're to be wise based on that knowledge. God says through Solomon, the ant has no guide, he has no overseer, he has no ruler. He has no one telling him what to do. We have helps, don't we? We're not left to our own devices, but we have those in authority over us in various spheres telling us, encouraging us what we ought to do. He's saying the ant doesn't have that. And yet, the ant provideth her meat in the summer and gathereth her food in the harvest. When there's an abundance, when it's time to gather, there's hard work and there's laying up aside. When profits can be had, the ant is about making profits and putting it aside. So when there are lean times, the ant can feed upon the surplus. That's the whole principle here, and it is related to sloth, particularly in the time that's extremely profitable. In the profitable time, it's the least time, or it's the less, it's the time that you should the most want to make the most of it. In other words, you can get away with being lazy when things are lean. obviously not good to be lazy at any time. But the point is, in the opportune time, that is uniquely the time not to be lazy, but to make the profit, to store up the goods for the lean times. And so then we have a number of rhetorical questions asked concerning sleeping. Sleeping obviously is necessary. It's a gift of God. We find the Lord gives us rest in our sleep, and yet we can sleep too much and neglect laboring to God's glory. And so what we're told is that if we do that, if we neglect gathering when we ought to be gathering, when gathering's there to be had, our poverty will come upon us as one that traveleth. I think I said travaileth, and I slipped there a little bit with the reading. Traveleth. In other words, it'll go away from you. Your wealth will vanish, and all of a sudden, you'll be poor because you weren't willing to work too hard and to be diligent and economical and frugal in the storing up of the goods. It's not only work hard so you make profit in those profitable times, but it's also not be too free with the money during those times, because the likelihood is they won't last. I think most of us have recognized the good times came to an end, didn't they? And they'll come to an end again. There'll be some more good times, and they'll come to an end in the country and in our own families economically. Consider another passage, another proverb, Proverb 21:20. There is treasure to be desired and oil in the dwelling of the wise, but a foolish man spendeth it up. The wise man accumulates and is careful not to overexpend oil. It's precious. It's important. And so the wise has some stored up. But the foolish man spendeth it up. He burns up all he has. And then he has no oil for his lamps. They actually used oil to clean themselves as well. So I think it's encouraging frugality now, so that our storehouse might last longer when things are a little bit tighter. I think we have the same principle in 2 Corinthians 8:14. I think this principle applies to giving, particularly giving in the church to those in need, or church giving, or presbytery giving to churches or presbyteries that are in unique needs because of either economic collapse in certain places of the world, or so-called natural disasters brought on by the hand of God. This is related to the Jerusalem offering, and Paul says in 2 Corinthians 8:14, but by equality, or by equity, that now at this time your abundance may be a supply for their want, that their abundance also may be a supply for your want, that there may be equity. As it is written, he that had gathered much had nothing over, and he that gathered little had no lack. Paul refers to the giving of manna by God and the gathering of it, and the fact that some had a capacity to gather more faster than others, but they all ended up getting the same amount. They're only allowed to have so much. And he uses that to say, hey, at this point, you in this part of the globe, you're economically prosperous. The saints in Jerusalem aren't. Your abundance will meet their want. But he even suggests the possibility exists someday their abundance may meet your want. Things may be drastically changed in the world economy. And there may come a time when your congregation needs the basics of life, needs the necessities of living. And so I think we can apply that broader principle to our own families. In an abundance, we need to be concerned about providing for the periods of want. William Sprague, in his Letters to Young Men, in a chapter called Economy, says this. He says, if you have enough and only enough to support you now, what will you do in the time of sickness when you will be unable to labor? What in the winter season of old age, if you should be spared to that period, when the grasshopper shall be a burden and the almond tree flourish? It's a reference to the last chapter of Ecclesiastes. Surely, you will not wish then to be dependent on the charity of the world. Cultivate economy then, now, as the preservative of such a calamity. And if no exigency should arise, you need not fear, but that your earnings may still be appropriated to bless and comfort your fellow creatures. In other words, if you end up not needing it yourself when your life is over, it will still be there to be a help to others. He just says generically to those others, your fellow creatures. I'm going to talk a minute, a little bit about investments, and I'm going to show that the first of those fellow creatures that we ought to have concern about are our parents and our children. But then our proceeds may be able to go beyond them in providing necessary support. Now, a couple practical suggestions after I mentioned just a couple practical antidotes. The Wall Street Journal informs us that 70% of Americans live paycheck to paycheck. They're that tight on their expenditures that they have nothing. 70% of Americans have nothing laid up in store. That paycheck doesn't come, they do not have the ability to purchase the things this month that they purchased last month. I already said the average American home is $50,000 in debt. And then they're living, 70% of them, on the next paycheck. So I think we do need to ask ourselves a question. How long could you and your family maintain your present lifestyle or an immediately reduced lifestyle if you suddenly lost your job or your health? In other words, how many months could you last on the current, if your income went to zero or nearly zero? Or figure it out based on what you know you would be able to make if you were immediately incapacitated. I think that's helpful for us to have some sense of how long that period would be. Aesop in The Ant and the Grasshopper says, it is thrifty, and this is the theme really, the moral of the story, is it is thrifty to prepare today for the wants of tomorrow. I mean, the heathen have observed these facts. These things are not just found in Scripture, but the same principle is there. We see as well Benjamin Franklin saying, if you would be wealthy, think of saving rather than getting. I think it's not wrong to be wealthy, but your focus ought to be on saving rather than on getting. Because getting doesn't necessarily produce wealth. Getting, if it's all spent, doesn't produce any wealth, does it? First practical suggestion is to establish, if you have not already, an emergency fund. I think it's got to be minimum a couple $1,000s in this day and age. You have a car breakdown, something like that, you could easily find yourself in a $500 or $1,000 situation like that. Right? Appliances. R.L. Dabney, in his Principles of Christian Economy, speaks of having reasonable provisions against the contingencies of the future. In other words, put up something because you don't know what the future has in store. We can trust God, but we're also called to plan. And there's a false dichotomy that exists, and it's prevalent in Christianity, that trusting God means no planning. That's a false dichotomy. We are to plan. So I would encourage you to have at least a couple thousand and eventually to try to have at least in easy to get money, at least a month's worth of expenses. And then eventually I think you need to be able to build it up to 3 months. Another thing you can do if you're working, not working for yourself, is you can build up vacation accrual. Someone recommended that to me early on in my career, and I've done that, and I've chosen to have the maximum amount of vacation that I'm allowed to have stored up. So I have nearly 3 months of vacation time stored up. So I have a 3-month cushion just there besides any savings. And that affords some ability to have a little flexibility in that if something was to happen. So emergency fund. Second, obviously you should save for major purchases. If you just graduated college, starting a job, or whatever situation, just getting into the work world, starting your life out, you're going to want a home problem. Like most of you will try to be homeowners. For the main, it will be a good investment in most cases. But if you can't put 20% down on that home, you're going to be paying mortgage insurance, which is a steep tax. So you're going to want to get to 20%. We'll talk a little bit more about that when we talk about housing. So you're going to have to save up some money. You're going to have to be pretty austere and put aside a good amount of money every month to be able to get to that point. You also would be smart to be able to save up to purchase automobiles, because clearly an automobile is something that you purchase that depreciates. And so it's much better to pay cash for it than to pay high interest for it. Also, most of us have children that we are going to probably have to expend more money for their education in the future than we are at present. So whatever our education expense today is probably going up. And we need to factor that in to our financial planning. So on those major purchases, we need to set aside money now for the future. How do we do that? I think we have to set a time goal. In other words, we're going to need a new vehicle 3 years from now. And it's probably 3 years from now going to cost about this. And ideally, we'd like to be able to save up all of the money for it. Now, what would that mean in terms of savings right now, this month, and every month for the next 36 months so we can have that wad of money? Once we realize that that can be done, then we have to implement that plan. We may say, no, we can't do that. We may really have to make this car last for 5 or 6 more years. Or we may have to lower our sights on the car we want in 3 years. But we have to make those decisions so that the next month we know what we're putting away for that goal. For getting that 20% to purchase the first home. Then to put aside the money for the first automobile. And then, you know, the first good automobile. And then we start to think about what are our educational plans. We have educational plans for our children that are going to incur a significant amount of money planning for those. So there are two practical suggestions related to savings. Now, I've differentiated savings and investing. I hope you'll see why. Savings is for that emergency and for those major purchases. Investing money. Let's talk the biblical basis and then the practical suggestions. Biblical basis falls into 3 categories. I think we need to invest money for 3 reasons. An inheritance for our children, the requiting of our parents, and supplementing our income in old age. Notice I didn't say retirement. Because even if we stop working at the place we're working, God would have us serve Him all our days in something meaningful. So we as Christians are not free to retire from the current employment and recreate all the last years of our lives. Doesn't mean we can't enjoy more time with our friends and family and do other things, but that is still labor unto the Lord. And it is itself a vocation. It's a calling. But those callings that we may desire to be involved in our later years may not remunerate us very well, if at all. And so we're going to have to put aside some money to be able to live while we do those things that we want to do in our waning years. So, biblical basis first for an inheritance for our children. Consider first the fact of inheritance. Some proverbs don't tell us what to do, they just tell us this is the way it is. And Proverbs 19:14 just tells us the way it is. Proverbs 19:14a says, houses and riches are the inheritance of fathers. Solomon goes on to say, and a prudent wife is from the Lord. Two different things. Houses and riches do come from God, but they come through fathers. Sometimes a prudent wife comes through a father, espying a woman. But ultimately, if a woman's prudent, she came from the Lord. If she's a discerning woman, she came directly from God. She can't be had by manipulation. But houses and riches are inheritance of fathers. That's the fact. Here's the duty in Proverbs 13:22a. A good man leaveth an inheritance to his children's children. The fact is, estates are passed on. But here we're told that a good man, a righteous man, he leaves an inheritance to his children's children. I think the focus there is upon the Spirit. That's his disposition. That's his desire. That doesn't always work out, does it? There have been many godly men through the ages that have not been able to give an inheritance to their children. But if they were good throughout their life, that would have been something they would have been desirous to have done if, in God's providence, they could have. We also learn in Proverbs 17:2, I think, that we don't need to consider inheritance as mechanical. There in Proverbs 17:2, we say, a wise servant shall have rule over a son that causeth shame, and shall have part of the inheritance among the brethren. Here's the picture of a master who has sons and who has slaves. And his slaves are pseudo-sons. In antiquity, slaves were treated like the family. But they weren't treated exactly like the family. All the slave boys didn't necessarily gain the inheritance. But the picture is here, a shameful son, he may be cut out of the inheritance, and a faithful servant boy, he may be factored in. He may be adopted in and treated as a legitimate son through adoption. That's the picture. So it doesn't need to be mechanical. It needs to be based on character of the individuals involved. I think we also see this principle, interestingly enough, in 1 Corinthians 12:14. Paul is dealing with the Corinthians, and he is bringing to them who are being exposed to false teachers who are slandering Paul. He's telling them about his ministry to them. And as he does, he gives them the reason for it. For the children ought not to lay up for parents, but the parents for the children. He likens himself to a parent, and they're the child. Quite often in the epistles, he says, I could have enforced my apostolic authority and could have taken from you. But what he's saying is, there's something more important, and that is that the parental desire to give to the child overrides the child's duty to the parent. There's a duty for children to give to their parents in need, but there's a parental love that operates in a unique way that desires to give to the child. And Paul says, that's what's motivating me, to keep giving to you. Whether you're giving ear to false teachers that are slandering me or not, I'm going to keep giving to you. Remember in 2 Corinthians, he says, your heart is restrained. Your heart's constricted. In other words, your love isn't flowing out to me, but I'll open my heart to you. My love will flow out to you. Paul was amazingly vulnerable. It takes quite a man to know who he is before God, to be able, when people are restricting their love towards him, to open up his heart to them and let the love flow out. And that's what he was doing, I think, in that passage. But I think it teaches us a principle of setting aside for our children. Secondly, let's consider the biblical basis for requiting our parents. Proverbs 28:24 says, "Whoso robbeth his father and his mother and saith, it is no transgression, the same is the companion of the destroyer." Now you might ask, does this proverb really apply? Whoso robbeth his father? Sounds like it's talking about stealing, doesn't it? But do you remember what Malachi 3:7 says? That if we don't give to God, we just haven't not given to God. We've just robbed God. So if we don't give to someone what is their due, we are, in fact, robbing them. So I believe this proverb is very applicable. Consider also the teaching of Matthew 15 and Mark 7. Here in these passages, we find a very strong, cogent argument for the regulative principle of worship. But it's interesting to see the context in which Jesus brings up this principle. Matthew 15, 1 through 6. Then came to Jesus scribes and Pharisees, which were of Jerusalem, saying, "Why do thy disciples transgress the tradition of the elders? For they wash not their hands when they eat bread." And he answered and said unto them, "Why do ye also transgress the commandment of God by your tradition?" They ask him, "Why don't your disciples do these traditions?" Jesus asks a question back. Why do your traditions override God's law? That's his answer. He doesn't begin a debate about hygienic practices with them. He knows there's something at the heart, and he goes right to the heart with another question. "For God commanded, saying," he's going to give an example of where they've done this very thing, where their tradition has overridden God's law. "For God commanded, saying, honor thy father and mother, and he that curseth father and mother, let him die the death. But ye say," here's what God says, but here's what you've put in place, "whosoever shall say to his father or his mother, it is a gift, by whatsoever thou mightest be profited by me, and honor not his father and his mother, he shall be free. And thus have ye made the commandment of God of none effect by your tradition." He says, you've kind of said to yourself in a vow, or maybe you've made a commitment to give so much money to the temple or to something. It's Corban. It's what's called Corban in Mark 7. It's literally a consecrated present. In other words, you've committed to give something, but now in providence, your parents need. And you can just say, well, I promised to give God that, or that's really consecrated unto God. I can't let you touch that money, that surplus. Because that's consecrated unto God. I can't disperse that to you in your need. And Jesus says you've overturned the fifth commandment by this practice. So clearly this is an example of not requiting your parents, and Jesus saying this is inconsistent with the fifth commandment. The fifth commandment would teach you to not do such a thing. Also consider 1 Timothy 5:4. "But if any widow have children or nephews, let them learn first to show piety at home and to requite their parents, for this is good and acceptable before God." In this passage that we find this verse, the Apostle Paul is laying down principles for Timothy, principles that were to guide the church from that time on until Christ returned. And he relates it to the church's diaconal support of widows. And in this passage, he seeks to distinguish between what he calls widows and widows indeed. Widows that can find their support through their families versus widows who have no families that can support them and need to be supported through the church. It's the difference that he's trying to make. Obviously, all widows are really widows, right? But there's widows that should be taken care of by their family. Paul's saying, if any widow have children or nephews, let them learn first to show piety at home. In other words, the children or the nephews, the extended family, first the nuclear family, then the extended family, ought to demonstrate piety or godliness within their own home sphere. And they ought to do that to requite or to pay back their parents. Their parents have given to them. Now they have an opportunity to give to their parents. This is good and acceptable before God, he says. So the principle is, church leaders, when you have a woman that's a widow, you have to evaluate what her nuclear family and extended family can do to support her first, before you begin formally to support her in her need. Because they need to demonstrate piety in home. In other words, you're really helping out the children and the nephews, the extended family. That's good for them. Because now they're being called by God to requite their parents, and they're able to do something which is good and acceptable before God. And so the church could just immediately go start paying the monthly expenses for the widow without doing that is in fact not helping the widow and not helping her extended family like they ought to. Not informing the extended family of their duty before God to help in the support of that widow. Thirdly, we've talked about investing money for inheritance for children, requiting of parents. Third, supplemental income in old age. I think the principle is found in 1 Timothy 5:8. But if any provide not for his own, and especially for those of their own house, he hath denied the faith and is worse than an infidel. Paul says even the heathen know that a man ought to take care of himself and his family. And though his family may have shrunk himself and his wife in his old age, yet he is responsible to plan for their sustenance in his old age. So we ought to have some concern about long-term provision. I believe this is the place where I at least broach the issue of insurance. I believe that insurance is not wrong, that we can plan to insure ourselves for contingencies and trust God at the same time. I don't believe it's an either-or to say, I'm trusting God so I don't have to have any insurance. You're free not to. It's not a sin if you don't. Necessarily. But I do think we need to think about what could we fall into at present or in the future. I think we ought to be moving to investing and saving so that we're eventually insuring ourselves. Bill brought up the point, he asked the question last week, is it surety? Is it similar to surety? And I think there is some similarities in that in one sense the insurance company is saying, give some money so I can pay off somebody that's in need. But I don't think you really have too many insurance men actually ever present their insurance that way, do they? They ever come to you and say, listen, you're healthy. You know, you're likely going to be healthy to 80 given the fact that you don't smoke, you're this, that, and the other thing, you run, your heart rate, everything else. But there's some needy people, and we're going to have to make at least 1,000 claims next month. So would you pitch in? So they really don't come that way. The issue is, am I willing to put in a little money now so that if I get hurt or sick right now, this is how much I will have from then on out. And so I think we can make that judgment about the risk that we take living in a world that we don't know what will happen next in God's providence and trusting God, and yet at the same time trying to plan for the catastrophe or for contingency for something going wrong. I think surety is where I sign up, and if Jim doesn't keep paying his car payments, then they don't repossess the car from Jim. They come and take the money out of my hide until they can any longer. Then they repossess the car. But insurance, we can opt out of the insurance premium any month we want. We haven't signed up to keep paying this for this many years. So I think in that sense, we can instantly get out of paying insurance if we realize God's brought something in our lives that we can no longer afford that luxury of carrying that premium to prevent against that contingency. And then we have to trust the Lord more, but we've done our planning. So I think we need to plan and trust. I think that's the place to consider insurance for supplemental income in old age or in early years if we were to have a capacitating accident or to come down with some illness. Let me quote again from William Sprague in his article on economy in his Letters to Young Men. He says, it is not worthwhile, it's a question. Is it not worthwhile to practice economy even in the possibility of such a result? He's talking about it, even in the result of things going well, you're never having any needs. Perhaps by this means you may be enabled to invite your parents in the decline of life to come and make their residence by the side of you, and to find their wants all supplied by your filial bounty. Or else, if you are separated from them, you may gladden their hearts by sending them their requisite supplies, the fruit of your habitual economy. Or else, like Joseph, you may have brothers who are in need, possibly brothers who, by some visitation of providence, are rendered unable to help themselves. What a comfort would it be to you to be able to stretch out the hand of charity to them and to offer them perhaps a quiet home and comfortable support. But even if you should have no relatives to require your assistance, you live in a world that is full of the suffering poor, in a world where the blessings of Christianity are not but partially diffused. I think he's referring to missions. In a world where money, worthless as we sometimes account it, will avail to a thousand purposes of human happiness and improvement. In other words, can't we give up a few of our pleasures in the present for our future needs, our family's future needs, or maybe the needs of the church or even our community in the future? Can't we give up just a little bit of all those luxuries that we involve ourselves in right now for storage for ourselves and potentially others in the future? A few practical suggestions. Obviously, it takes money to make money, doesn't it? First, you need to have a basic will. I'll confess, I'm guilty of not having a basic will. I got to get that right. Somebody come ask me a couple months from now, please, if I have a will. We can invest. We can obviously diversify our investments. Ecclesiastes 11:2 says, give a portion to seven and also to eight, for thou knowest not what evil shall be upon the earth. Ecclesiastes 11:2. In other words, don't put all your savings in one commodity. That commodity may not be so important in the future. Something radical happens with technology and all of a sudden you have a big all your investments are in one thing that's no longer needed at this point. It may be needed in the economy 100 years from now. That thing might be a great investment for 100 years from now or 1,000 years from now. But that's all you have right now. And you're going to be long gone before that's ever worth anything again. So diversify your portfolio. Gold or precious metals. I'm not an expert here. Dave Ramsey says don't play with it, no matter what some of the TV infomercials tell you. I'd have to do some more thorough studies about it. It has gone up. The question is, in a completely collapsed economy, how important is gold? Just because it's continued to go up in an economy that exists, how valuable is it when the economy completely collapses? Also, is gold and silver really a limited resource? I'm not saying that God's making more gold and silver. The question is, how much gold and silver do we even know about? How much is still in the earth? So its supply is expanding. Just like the money supply expands, the gold and the silver supply expands, people. So don't be deceived into thinking it is just this big and so the prices have to go up. What is this big if you consider the whole of all of God's creation, right, how do we know how much silver and gold is in the universe? Much less how much is in the crust of the earth. With technology, I believe that if we could find veins of silver and gold that would significantly increase the current so-called supply. So I do think there's some basic questions that have to be asked about that. Whole life policies, I hope you would all recognize whole life policies are not good in terms of the money you're putting into them. Using those as a savings or investment plan is not good. If you need insurance, you should be purchasing term insurance based on your age, and you should be looking at some point to be able to insure yourself. So as your age goes up and your risk goes up and your premiums go up, at some point you opt out of the premiums and say, I've got enough to cover my needs in an emergency. But obviously real estate, there is only so many acres in the world. That doesn't change. I mean, just go all the way down, hasn't been explored, but there's only so much surface of the earth. That's not changing. And land that's farmland that can be used to cultivate necessities, obviously, it's not going to profit like the stock market or a business, but it is very stable. And it can provide you a source of income in a collapsing or a collapsed economy. You can also invest in local family businesses, entrepreneurs who you know, not who have a slick portfolio, but who you know, and you know that their product is good, and you know the principles by which they produce that product are in accordance with God's Word for the most part. That's a good place to invest. And also, you can obviously invest in stock, in companies that you ought to take an interest in knowing something about and keep on knowing something about. Or you can invest in mutual funds to hedge, basically allow them to diversify for you. And you can diversify by not being all in one fund. Dave Ramsey said mutual funds, this is what he said a couple years ago in his book, Total Money Makeover Workbook. Mutual funds will average 12% over a 10-year period or longer. When I read it, I put a question mark there. What 10-year period? When does that start? What's the plus or minus? Is it plus 1 year, minus 1 year? How do you do that math? Because you can, any period, you can go from January 1st, 2000 to January 1st, 2010. You cannot tell me that the market has increased 10%, 12% per year. So what's he actually saying? All I have to do is look at the 9 funds that my company has in their 401k and look at the 5-year interest, and there's only 3 of them out of the 9 that are in the black that are plus for the last 5 years. So I'm having a hard time believing those funds will earn 12% per year in a 10-year period when at present they're below zero for the most recent 5-year period. That may have changed a little bit on Thursday, Friday, but not that much. Bill was kind enough to tell me that he thinks 10% is a more reasonable figure. I've always kind of operated on 10 is the higher, and if you're making less than 7, you're probably doing something wrong. And that's based on our economy. So 7 to 10, and if you use the rule of 7 tens, 7% interest basically doubles your money in 10 years, 10% interest basically doubles your money in 7 years. I think that's helpful to know. Dave Ramsey does recommend, in terms of mutual funds, that you diversify into at least four types of funds. So the funds themselves are diversified, and then you're diversifying into several funds, and then you may also be investing in real estate or local family business, those kind of things, your own business. The four types are growth and income funds, growth funds, international funds, and aggressive growth. I think that's a good rubric. Bill also was kind to verify a rubric that I heard years before, and that is that you ought to have the percentage of your portfolio based on your age in fixed income or bond funds. So that if Timothy's going in the workforce at 22, he only needs about 22% in that fixed fund. But when he plans to retire at 65, it'd be a good idea for him to have 65% of his portfolio in bond fund, because now he can't afford and be quite so aggressive, because now he's going to have to start needing that money. So I think that's a helpful thing for us to consider. One other thing I want to mention is just an example of the beauty or the wonder of compound interest. Compound interest. Quick example. Two people. Dave Ramsey's example are Jimmy and Susan. They're 21. They get into the workforce at 21. They're going to retire at 65. Susan puts $1,000 away per year for 8 years. What's her total investment? $8,000. If, in fact, she could get 12% on her mutual funds at 65, she would have $427,000. Put $8,000 away. 1,000 at 21, 1,000 at 22, 1,000 at 23. By 28, she'd put $8,000 in the bank, in the investments, in the 401k. 12%, she gets $427,000. Now, Jimmy wants the newest BMW as he comes out of college. He wants to live in the most yuppie apartment. He doesn't like the $30 or $40 polos. He wants the latest $100 ones. He wants the alligator on him or the new little blue fish. Okay, that's going to run in $100. That's what he wants. So he can't put $1,000 away. He can't find a way to put $1,000 away a year. Less than $100 a month. He can't do it. Finally, he decides to listen to the counsel of his parents and others. And at 29, he decides to get on a stick. Susan's already got $8,000 plus this $12,000 accruing for those 8 years. She comes into some hard times. She doesn't put another penny away from the time she's 28. But she put $1,000 away for 8 years in a row. Jimmy gets started at 29, puts $1,000 away a year from 29 to 65. Over 35 years. 37 years to be exact. Total investment, $37,000. How much does he get at the end? $363,000. Not a bad sum. But Susan, who was willing on the front end to live without a little bit, putting that money away early, ends up having more money at 65. It does say something about getting started early when you're single. You got some extra spending money. You don't have a lot of those expenses. That's the time to be hoarding at some level. Not enjoy yourself and enjoy the proceeds that the Lord's given you. But it does warn you about the danger or the benefits of compound interest and danger not saving now. Also, I'd encourage you to maximize your 401k benefits, particularly if you have matching funds. That's what I'm really talking about. Because obviously some of the things that are available in certain plans aren't as good as others. So you may not want to put all your investments there. But if your company's giving you a dollar per dollar or 50 cents per a dollar, you ought to put all that you can to get that matching fund. That's easy money, right? 50 cents on a dollar, that's 50% interest for the first year. In most of the plans, you can take money out of it after 3 or 5 years of vesting. It's still a pretty good deal to get 50% for 1 year, even if you have to wait 5 years to get it. You basically, see, if you want to move out of the workforce at 65 to do another vocation, most people are going to have to put away about 10% of their income to be able to do that. And people that are currently going into the workforce that have no benefits package from their companies will have to probably put in the neighborhood of 15% away. Given the expanded life expectancies for most people, that's the kind of amount of money that you'd have to put away so that you could live on your interest at 65 on. Now, if you plan to have a part-time job or earn money in the vocation, that's a different factor. If you expect just to live on your money, and you can't, this is not saying you're going to get a penny from Social Security. I don't believe you ought to be planning for Social Security benefits. You might have them. If they're just on the horizon, you can, and you have to, you better begin to plan for them. If you're 22, you better be investing as though there is no Social Security for you. You'd be a fool to be investing as though wanting to do the Lord's work and support yourself at 65, thinking that Uncle Sam's going to pick up part of that. So that's some of the recommendations. But in application, I want us to realize that these are all heart issues. Consider Luke 12, 13 through 21. Luke 12. I've been encouraging you to hoard money away, haven't I? And yet we have this parable in Luke 12, 13 and following. After someone has come to Jesus asking him to divide the inheritance with his brother, some question about the inheritance. Looks like his father maybe chose to give it to his brother. Sounds like he may have been a son that caused shame. And he wants it split. He doesn't like the way the will was written. So he comes to Jesus to get it resolved. Jesus doesn't resolve it. He doesn't say, I'm not the judge, go to the judge. He knows there's a spiritual issue. He goes, deals with the spiritual issue. And he speaks a parable of a certain rich man who's brought forth plenty. It says, and he thought within himself, verse 17, saying, what shall I do? Because I have no room where to bestow my fruits. I've got so much coming in, my barns won't hold it. And he said, this will I do. I will pull down my barns and build greater. And there will I bestow all my fruits and my goods. My is just throughout this parable. Not what God's given him. And he's keeping it all. He's not giving off some. He's hoarding it all for himself. And I will say to my soul, here it comes, here, talking to himself rather than listening to God. I will say to my soul, soul, thou hast made goods, or you have much goods laid up for many years. Take thine ease, eat, drink, and be merry. But God said unto him, thou fool, this night thy soul shall be required of thee. Then who shall those things be which thou hast provided? Then he gives the moral of the story, of the parable. So is he that layeth up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God. Remember, as you're seeking to save and invest, don't be laying up riches for yourself. Be doing it before God in his fear, trying to honor him in making money, saving money, investing money, returning money, giving money, paying money, and spending money. God calls us to do them all. We have one proverb that speaks to the same point. Proverb 23, 4, and 5. Let me read that quickly. Proverbs 23, 4, and 5. Labor not to be rich. Cease from thine own wisdom. Wilt thou set thine eyes upon that which is not? For riches certainly make themselves wings. They fly away as an eagle toward heaven. Save and invest money, but don't put your heart into them. Because as much as you're saving or investing, it can be gone like that in a flash. I'll close with Sprague again on economy. Practice the virtue of economy. Live frugally that you may live not for yourself alone. That if you do not leave behind your wealth to be distributed for the benefit of others, you may at least leave behind you an example which will be for the interest of others to imitate. In other words, try to do what's right on what you can do based on where God's placed you providentially. Attempt to live within your means so you can help others. And if at the end of the day, when you die, you have nothing to give to others, at least people can imitate your lifestyle. Let us close in prayer.